A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one, and it starts from a place I know personally. You remember we talked about his driving anxiety? Grew up in Ireland, loving the road, moved to Israel, and suddenly getting behind the wheel feels like preparing for battle. But here's the thing that stuck with me. He said the dread is worse before he starts the engine. 10 minutes into the drive, it's gone. That's a textbook pattern. Anticipatory situational driving anxiety. And there's a specific evidence-based therapy for exactly this, using VR, that almost nobody knows exists.
The parallel he draws is the one that really gets me. He's got ADHD, became a father, and suddenly all his organizational systems hit their ceiling. Occupational therapy is designed for precisely that scenario, but he only found out about it years after his diagnosis. Most people with ADHD never hear the words occupational therapy in connection with their own brain.
So the question isn't, do effective therapies exist? The question is, why are they invisible? And what does it cost us when millions of people are suffering through treatable conditions because the information never reached them?
This is the awareness gap. And Daniel's two experiences, driving anxiety and ADHD, they're not separate problems. They're the same problem wearing different coats. Let's dig into both.
Let's start with the driving anxiety piece, because that one's so clean. You have a specific fear, driving in Israeli traffic. The anticipatory anxiety spikes before you even get in the car. Then you actually drive, and 10 minutes later your brain goes, "Oh, we're fine." And the anxiety evaporates. That pattern, dread before, relief during, is the signature of a phobic response maintained by avoidance and catastrophizing, not by actual danger on the road.
This is where VR exposure therapy is almost surgically precise. The mechanism is graded exposure. You confront the feared situation in steps, from least to most anxiety-provoking, until your brain learns the catastrophic prediction didn't come true. Traditionally, you'd do this in real life, which for driving anxiety means you and a therapist actually get in a car. But VR changes the equation completely. In a VR setup, the therapist has a control panel. They can adjust traffic density in real time, start you on an empty country road, then add a few cars, then moderate traffic, then Tel Aviv at rush hour. They control the weather. They can put you at a busy intersection or on a highway merge and dial any of these up or down based on your physiological response in the moment. In real life, you get whatever traffic you get. If it's too intense, too fast, you're flooded and the session backfires.
It's exposure therapy with a dimmer switch instead of an on-off toggle.
And the evidence backs this up. A randomized controlled trial out of the University of Haifa in 2024 compared VR exposure therapy to traditional in vivo exposure for driving anxiety. The outcomes were equivalent in symptom reduction. But the dropout rate for VR therapy was 8%. For real-world exposure, it was 22%.
People were bailing on the very thing that could help them, because getting in a real car when you're terrified of driving is itself a barrier. The VR approach lets you do the hard work from a chair in a clinic. Your brain still does the learning. The amygdala doesn't care that the traffic isn't physically real. The perceptual system processes it as real enough to trigger the anxiety, and that's what you need for habituation to occur. After 6 to 8 sessions, studies show a 70-80% reduction in symptoms.
6 to 8 sessions. And the cost? A typical VR therapy course runs $800 to $1,500 out of pocket. Traditional exposure therapy with in-car sessions? $2,000 to $4,000. So it's cheaper, more accessible, the dropout rate is lower, and the outcomes are equivalent.
Here's the obvious question. If it's cheaper, easier to complete, and just as effective, why did Daniel, someone actively looking for solutions who works in tech, why did he not know this existed?
A 2025 survey found that 12% of adults with driving anxiety had ever heard of VR therapy as an option. That means 88% of the people who could benefit have no idea it's available. The American Psychological Association recommends it. The research is solid. Clinics exist in most major cities.
That's not a failure of science. That's a failure of information architecture. The therapy exists, the evidence exists, the practitioners exist, and the people who need it are walking around thinking their only options are to white-knuckle through it or avoid driving forever.
That brings us to the second case study, which follows the exact same pattern, Daniel's ADHD. He gets diagnosed, tries medication, tries talk therapy, both helpful, both standard of care. But then he becomes a father, and the executive function demands of his life suddenly double. Keeping track of a child's schedule, managing a household on top of work, the constant interruptions that shred any fragile organizational system. Classic demand exceeds capacity for an ADHD brain.
The solution most people hear about is, what? Try a different medication. Use a planner.
Use a planner. The most infuriating advice. But occupational therapy for adult ADHD isn't about trying harder. It's about changing the environment to match how your brain actually works. Environmental modification. Redesigning your physical space so the things you need are visible and distractions are minimized. Sensory regulation strategies. Understanding that some ADHD brains need background noise or movement to focus, while others need quiet and reduced visual clutter. Time blindness interventions. Externalizing time with visual timers, building buffer zones into schedules, using analog clocks because seeing time as a spatial quantity helps some ADHD brains process it better.
None of this is just be more disciplined. It's engineering. It's treating your environment as something you can redesign rather than something you just have to cope with.
Here's where the numbers get stark. A 2025 survey from the American Occupational Therapy Association found that only 23% of adults diagnosed with ADHD had ever been referred to an occupational therapist. Meanwhile, 89% had been prescribed medication, and 67% had tried talk therapy.
Nearly 9 out of 10 get medication. 2 out of 3 get talk therapy. Fewer than 1 in 4 even hear about the therapy that addresses the "how do I run my life" piece.
A 2023 meta-analysis in the Journal of Attention Disorders put numbers on what that missed opportunity costs. Occupational therapy interventions for adult ADHD produced an effect size of D equals 0.72 for executive function outcomes. Medication came in at D equals 0.81. Those are comparable. OT isn't replacing medication. They work on different mechanisms. But in terms of actually improving your ability to plan, organize, and execute daily tasks, OT delivers results in the same ballpark as stimulants.
Comparable effect sizes to medication for the thing that most disrupts daily life, and 3/4 of patients never get told it's an option. What is actually happening here?
Part of it is the name. Occupational therapy sounds like it's about your job. It's not. It comes from occupations of daily life, the things that occupy your time, but the term is a century old and it's terrible marketing. There was a proposal in 2024 to rebrand to Lifestyle Medicine Therapy, which the professional body rejected.
Lifestyle Medicine Therapy is somehow worse. It sounds like a spa package, but I take your point. The name is a barrier.
Most primary care physicians get minimal exposure to occupational therapy in medical school, and what they do learn is usually about stroke rehabilitation or pediatric developmental delays. The idea that OT is relevant for adult ADHD, for executive function, for mental health, that's simply not in the curriculum. So when a patient says, "I can't keep my life organized," the doctor reaches for the tools they know, medication, maybe a referral to a psychologist for CBT. OT doesn't even appear on the menu.
You've got a naming problem, a training gap in medical education, and a visibility problem that's worse for therapies not backed by pharmaceutical marketing budgets. Nobody's running Super Bowl ads for occupational therapy.
That's the structural piece. Medications have marketing. Talk therapy has cultural cachet. It's in movies, in celebrity interviews. Occupational therapy has none of that. It's not that OT is less effective. The effect sizes say otherwise. It's that nobody is telling the story.
The cost is not just individual suffering. Think about the aggregate. Talented people underperforming relative to their ability, because they're spending enormous cognitive resources just managing the friction between their brain and their environment. They're exhausted by 3 p.m., not because the work is too hard, but because the systems they're using are fighting them. And there's a therapy that can fix that, and they don't know it exists.
The societal loss is staggering. lost productivity, but also untreated comorbidities. Anxiety and depression that develop as secondary consequences of chronic executive function struggles, relationships that erode because one partner is constantly compensating for the other's organizational chaos, and neither understands it's not a character flaw, it's a solvable environmental mismatch.
We've got two therapies, VR for driving anxiety, OT for adult ADHD, both evidence-based, both recommended by their professional bodies, both cheaper than the alternatives they match or exceed in effectiveness. And in both cases, the overwhelming majority of people who could benefit have never heard of them. 12% awareness for VR driving therapy, 23% referral rate for OT and ADHD.
These two are almost certainly not unique. The pattern, effective therapy exists, evidence is solid, public has no idea, probably describes dozens of interventions across mental health, neurodivergence, chronic pain, sleep disorders. How many other things are hiding in plain sight?
That's the question that should keep us up at night. But before we go looking for more examples, I want to understand the mechanism. What is it about how healthcare information flows, or fails to flow, that produces this pattern over and over?
The first thing to name is that this isn't a knowledge problem, it's a discovery problem. The information exists, it's published in peer-reviewed journals, it's in clinical practice guidelines, it's taught in specialized training programs. But none of those channels face the public. The average person with driving anxiety isn't reading the Journal of Anxiety Disorders, they're Googling, "Why am I terrified of driving?" at 2 in the morning.
What did they find?
Blog posts about deep breathing. Maybe a Psychology Today article about general anxiety. What they don't find is a clear path from "I have this specific problem" to "here is the specific therapy designed for it." The signposting doesn't exist.
It's a wayfinding failure. You're in a city you don't know. You know there's a train station somewhere, but there are no signs, and your map app is showing you restaurants instead.
And the reasons this keeps happening are structural, not accidental. First, referral networks are sticky. A primary care physician refers to the specialists they know, and they know the ones they trained with or who've been practicing in their system for 20 years. VR exposure therapy is relatively new in clinical practice. It's only been widely available for maybe a decade. It hasn't had time to get baked into the referral habits of an entire generation of doctors.
Occupational therapy for adult ADHD. Same story. Different timeline?
OT has been around for over a century, but its application to adult mental health and neurodivergence is much newer. The research on OT for adult ADHD has only really accumulated in the last 10 to 15 years. So you've got a profession that most doctors already associate with pediatrics and stroke rehab, and new evidence that says it's effective for something completely different. That's a harder sell than introducing a brand new therapy, because you have to overcome the existing mental model first.
It's easier to teach someone something new than to convince them that what they already know is incomplete. The "I know what occupational therapy is" problem.
That's before we even get to the incentive structure. In the U.S. healthcare system, and Israel's is different but shares some dynamics, the therapies that get visibility are the ones with reimbursement codes and marketing budgets. Medication has both. Talk therapy has cultural momentum and growing insurance coverage. But VR exposure therapy is often out of pocket, and OT for adult ADHD frequently requires jumping through prior authorization hoops that make referral less likely.
The structural forces are referral inertia, outdated professional mental models, and economic incentives that favor the therapies people already know about. That's a self-reinforcing loop. The unknown stays unknown because the system has no mechanism for surfacing it.
There is a fourth factor that's under-discussed. Stigma and self-blame. Someone with driving anxiety often thinks, "I'm just a nervous driver, I need to get over it." Someone with ADHD who can't keep their life organized thinks, "I'm lazy," or "I'm not trying hard enough." They don't go looking for a therapy because they don't frame the problem as treatable, they frame it as a personal failing.
Which means the awareness gap isn't just about information not reaching people. It's about people not knowing they should be looking in the first place. If you think your problem is a character flaw, you don't search for a clinical solution. You search for self-help books about willpower.
That's why Daniel's framing, "talented people available, and we're just missing awareness to connect the dots," isn't just a communication problem. It's a layered failure. The information exists, but the pathways to discover it are broken. the therapies exist, but the referral systems don't surface them, and the people who need them exist, but they've been taught to blame themselves rather than seek a different kind of help.
When we talk about bridging this gap, we're not just talking about better PR for occupational therapy. We're talking about rewiring how healthcare information flows from research to patient.
Let's stay with the VR mechanism for a minute, because understanding why it works so well is key to understanding why nobody knows about it. The core insight is that phobic anxiety operates on a prediction error model. Your brain predicts catastrophe. You avoid driving. The prediction never gets tested, so the fear survives unchallenged.
The avoidance is the preservative. Every time you don't drive, your brain goes, "See, we stayed safe. The avoidance worked."
And the only way to break that loop is to expose the brain to the feared situation and let it learn the catastrophe doesn't happen. But here's the problem with traditional exposure, dosing. If you flood someone, their amygdala goes into overdrive, they dissociate, and no learning occurs. If you go too slow, the therapy drags on forever.
The therapist's job is to find the Goldilocks zone. Enough anxiety to trigger learning, not so much that the system overloads.
In a real car, that's nearly impossible to calibrate. You can plan a route, but you can't control what happens on it. Somebody cuts you off. The traffic is unexpectedly light and the session is useless, or unexpectedly heavy and the patient spirals. The therapist is essentially guessing.
Whereas in VR, the therapist is conducting an orchestra. They're watching your heart rate, seeing your galvanic skin response, and adjusting the environment in real time. Let's add two more cars. Heart rate's at 90. Let's hold here until it drops to 75. Then we'll add the pedestrian.
That's exactly the protocol. The HIFA study documented that the VR condition allowed for within-session habituation, where the anxiety response declines during the session itself, not just between sessions. That's the gold standard for exposure therapy. You want the patient to experience the fear, stay in the situation, and feel it diminish. That's the corrective learning.
The VR isn't just a cheaper simulation of real driving. It's actually a superior delivery mechanism for the therapeutic ingredient, controlled, titrated exposure.
In some ways, yes. And that's hard to communicate to the public. People hear VR therapy and picture a gimmick, someone with a headset playing a driving game. They don't picture a precision clinical tool that lets a trained therapist control stimulus intensity with a granularity impossible in the physical world.
Which brings us back to the 12%. But there's another angle. What's the actual provider bottleneck? How many therapists are trained to do this?
The equipment isn't the barrier. A decent VR headset costs a few $100s, and clinical software platforms are increasingly affordable. The bottleneck is training. You need a therapist who understands both anxiety disorders and the VR protocol. Most clinical psychology programs don't teach VR exposure therapy. It's something you seek out through specialized workshops or postgraduate certification.
Providers are few and clustered in major cities. If you're in Haifa or Tel Aviv or New York, you can probably find someone. If you're in a smaller city, maybe not.
That creates a chicken and egg problem. Low provider density means low visibility. Low visibility means low demand. Low demand means few people enter the specialization. The cycle reinforces itself.
Yet the cost is still lower than traditional exposure therapy, even with the training premium. And the dropout rate difference, 8% versus 22%, those are real people who started a treatment and didn't finish it. Nearly 1 in 4 walked away in the in vivo condition.
If we're mapping the awareness gap for VR driving therapy, it's not one thing. It's a stack. Misunderstood mechanism. People think it's a game. Low provider density. No marketing budget. And a referral system that doesn't know it exists. Each layer makes the next one worse.
Now the occupational therapy story has all the same layers, plus a bonus one. OT has been around for over 100 years, and most of what it actually does is invisible to the public.
People know OT exists. They just think it's for helping kids with handwriting or stroke patients relearning how to button a shirt. The idea that an occupational therapist would sit down with an adult with ADHD and redesign their kitchen so the things they need are visible and the distractions are behind cabinet doors, that's not in anyone's mental model.
It's not that people have never heard of occupational therapy. It's that they've heard of it wrong. The category is occupied by the wrong examples.
That's harder to fix than pure ignorance. If someone has never heard of a thing, you just tell them. If they've heard of it but filed it under pediatric developmental stuff, you have to first unfile it, then refile it correctly. Two cognitive steps instead of one.
Which means the awareness gap for OT isn't just about reach. It's about conceptual real estate. The term already has a meaning in people's heads, and it's the wrong meaning for this application.
Here's what makes it worse. That 2023 analysis found OT interventions for adult ADHD produced an effect size of D equals 0.72 for executive function outcomes. Medication came in at D equals 0.81 for the thing that makes adult ADHD disabling. Not the attention, not the hyperactivity, but the inability to consistently execute the tasks you intend to do. And 3/4 of patients never hear about it.
Because medication works on neurochemistry. OT works on environmental design. They're completely different mechanisms, and for a lot of people, you need both. The medication helps your brain regulate dopamine so you can focus. The OT helps you build an environment where focus is actually possible. If your desk faces a window onto a busy street, no amount of medication is going to fix the constant visual interruptions.
It's not either or. It's that most people are only getting half the solution, and they don't know the other half exists.
Daniel's situation is a textbook example of why this matters. He had medication. He had systems that worked. Then he became a father, and the executive function demands essentially doubled overnight. This is what OT calls demand exceeds capacity. The environment changed, the demands increased, and the existing strategies couldn't scale.
Which is exactly the kind of inflection point where someone either finds the right help or they don't. And if they don't, they conclude the problem is them. I used to be able to handle this, now I can't. I must be getting worse.
That self-blame is part of the awareness gap, too. If you think your disorganization is a personal failure, you don't go looking for a clinical intervention. You try harder. You buy another planner. You beat yourself up.
The societal cost is enormous. The anxiety and depression that develop when you're constantly failing at things other people seem to do effortlessly. The marriages that strain under the weight of one partner compensating for the other's executive function gaps with neither understanding it's a solvable environmental mismatch.
The professional cost. Daniel's phrase, talented people available. That's accurate. You have highly skilled, capable people underperforming relative to their ability because they're spending 30% of their cognitive resources just managing the friction between their brain and their environment. That's a net loss to every field they work in.
We've mapped the problem. Misunderstood category, broken referral pathways, no marketing budget, self-blame that prevents people from seeking solutions. What I keep coming back to is, this isn't a knowledge problem. The research exists. The practitioners exist. The protocols are documented. The failure is in the information architecture, how people discover what's available.
That's a design problem, not a science problem. It's wayfinding. The fix isn't just more awareness campaigns. The fix is structural, changing how healthcare information flows from research to the people who need it.
Let's get concrete. If you're listening and you recognize yourself in the driving anxiety pattern, the dread before, the relief 10 minutes in, there's a path. Search VR exposure therapy, plus your city. If nothing comes up locally, check the Anxiety and Depression Association of America's provider directory. They list therapists by modality. And even if your current therapist doesn't offer VR, ask them specifically about it. The question alone might prompt them to look into it or refer you to someone who does.
Don't let the word VR make you think this is experimental or fringe. It's APA recommended. It's been through multiple randomized controlled trials. The barrier isn't evidence. It's that nobody told you.
For the ADHD side, the action is similar, but the search terms are different. Ask your psychiatrist or primary care provider for an occupational therapy referral and be specific. Say executive function coaching or OT for adult ADHD. Don't just say occupational therapy and hope they connect the dots, because as we've seen, they probably won't.
If your doctor says OT is for kids with handwriting problems, you now know enough to push back gently. Say, I've read that OT has evidence for adult executive function support. Can we look into that? You're not being difficult. You're being informed.
There's also a directory through the American Occupational Therapy Association. You can filter by specialty. Look for practitioners who list neurodivergent adults or executive function in their profiles. They're just not the ones getting the automatic referrals.
Here's the broader thing Daniel's really getting at. These two therapies are examples, not the whole list. The pattern repeats. So the most powerful tool a patient has might be a single question. Are there other evidence-based options I should know about?
That question is a skeleton key. When a doctor suggests a treatment that doesn't feel quite right, or that you've tried and it hasn't worked, asking that exact question forces the conversation out of the default grooves. It signals that you're not just looking for the standard protocol, you're looking for the right fit.
It works because it doesn't require the provider to already know everything. It just requires them to be willing to look. A good clinician asked that question will say, "Let me check what's available," rather than "No, this is the standard approach."
The awareness gap, at bottom, is a design flaw in how healthcare information is organized. We have an incredible research enterprise that produces evidence. We have trained practitioners who can deliver the interventions. And we have essentially no system for matching problem to solution at the patient level. It's all ad hoc. It depends on what your particular doctor happened to learn about 15 years ago, or what you stumble across on the internet at 2 in the morning.
A train station with no signs. The information exists, the destination exists, but the paths are invisible, and the fix isn't one big awareness campaign. It's building better infrastructure for discovery. Clinical decision support tools that surface evidence-based options. Referral systems that don't just default to the familiar. Provider directories that let patients search by symptom pattern, not just by profession name.
On the patient side, it's normalizing the question. What else should I know about? Shouldn't be seen as challenging the doctor's authority. It should be seen as participating in your own care. The best clinicians already welcome it.
Daniel's framing was talented people available, and we're just missing awareness to connect the dots. The dots are the therapies that exist but stay hidden. The awareness isn't just about marketing. It's about building systems where the right therapy finds the right person, instead of hoping they stumble into each other.
Until those systems exist, the best tool we've got is the question. Make your provider work a little harder. The solutions might already be sitting there, fully developed, evidence-backed, waiting for someone to name them.
Here's the thing I can't stop thinking about. We've mapped two therapies. VR for driving anxiety, OT for adult ADHD, and in both cases, the pattern is identical. Evidence exists. Outcomes are strong, costs are reasonable, and 80 to 90% of the people who need them have no idea. What else is out there?
That's the genuinely unsettling question. If these two examples, both well-studied, both recommended by their professional bodies, are this invisible, the number of other effective interventions hiding in plain sight has to be large. We don't know what we don't know, and the system isn't designed to tell us.
Here's where it gets interesting, looking forward. AI-driven diagnostic tools are getting better at pattern matching, taking a symptom cluster and suggesting possible matches. In theory, that infrastructure could close the awareness gap. A system that knows about VR exposure therapy and knows you have anticipatory driving anxiety could simply...
The flip side is equally possible. If the algorithms are trained on referral patterns, and referral patterns are biased toward the familiar, they could harden the gap instead of closing it. The system learns that everyone with ADHD gets medication and CBT, so that's what it recommends. OT never enters the training data because it was never referred, so the model never learns it's effective. The invisibility gets automated.
The algorithm doesn't discover. If the human system has a blind spot, the AI inherits it and scales it. So the question isn't whether AI will fix this. It's whether we build these tools to surface evidence-based options the humans are missing, or to optimize the referral patterns the humans already use.
That's a design choice, not a technical inevitability. You could build a clinical decision support tool that draws from the actual evidence base, analyses, RCTs, practice guidelines, rather than from historical referral data. But that's harder, and it requires someone to prioritize it over the cheaper option of just modeling what doctors already do.
Which brings me back to Daniel's original framing. His driving anxiety and his ADHD struggles aren't failures of will. They're failures of information. The solutions exist. The therapies work. The missing piece isn't effort or discipline or trying harder. It's that nobody built the bridge between the person with the problem and the thing that could help.
Building that bridge, that's not a patient responsibility. It's a system responsibility. Patients can ask good questions, and they should. But the real fix is designing healthcare information architecture so that the question doesn't have to be asked in the first place. The right option should be findable.
Connect the dots. That's the task. The dots are all there. The research, the practitioners, the protocols, the people who need them. What's missing is the lines between them. And until we draw those lines, we're going to keep having this same conversation about different therapies, different conditions, same pattern.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the late Victorian period, a pigment manufacturer in the Outer Hebrides produced a deep blue dye from local kelp that, when applied to wool, shifted visibly toward violet in low light, a property caused by trace iodine compounds in the seaweed interacting with the lanolin in untreated fleece.
Right. This has been my weird prompts. Thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you've got a question you want us to dig into, email the show at show@myweirdprompts.com.
We'll be back next week.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.